welcome to Cardicast, a glam podcast brought to you by New Cardigan. Our April Melbourne Cardi Party was hosted by Christine Healy, Curator, Education and Community Learning at the Incinerator Gallery in Aberfeldy, and Vice President of Envy, a special interest group for school and community engagement professionals working in galleries, libraries, archives and museums in Victoria, Australia. Seen today as a model for town and community activism, we were treated to a short tour of this last remaining Victorian, Walter Burley Griffin-designed incinerator by gallery team leader Richard Ennis, who also gave an overview of the incinerator's architecture and history, including how it has transformed into a vibrant art gallery advocating for social change. Following the tour was a panel discussion on education and the future of our roles in the glam sector with panel members Christine Healy, Nick McGrath, Sasha Fawkes and Andrew Hiskins.
Well, my name's Richard Ennis. I'm the team leader. We're a local government gallery, so I'll give a name like team leader. I'm the gallery director here at the Incinerator Gallery. So we're a council-owned facility. We function basically as a contemporary art space. But part of the whole rationale about council maintaining this space is that it's a heritage listed building. So the building that we're in now is listed by the Royal College of Architects as being one of the most important buildings in the state architecturally. It's a Walter Burley Griffin building. And this morning I was just going to give a little bit of a historical account of the building. We can do that, as I was saying, downstairs at the incinerators, because I'm in the middle of developing a permanent historical display downstairs, so it's all fresh in my mind, all these little bits of text and so on that we're writing. And then I'll talk a little bit about how all that history informs our programming here. So if you follow me, we'll go downstairs. So where do we start? I guess, look, the site that we're standing on now used to be a wetlands area that was associated with the Maribyrnong River. People who have come down the hill might know that it's about another 100 metres further on, not even that, is the Maribyrnong. And this is on a big bend of the Maribyrnong. It's a wetlands area, like billabongs. Every winter they flooded, filled with water. There'd be water in there most of the year. Essendon developed up on the high ground, the road to Mount Alexander during the Gold Rush. So it was about one day's walk out of Melbourne. All the houses, the post offices, the hotels started on Mount Alexander Road. Essentially, they threw their rubbish down the hill into this wetlands area, the swamp they called it. And they did have that idea that they were going to be creating landfill, that it was going to fill up with rubbish and they could use it as park or be useful land because they didn't see it as being very useful. That actually never really worked. The Maribyrnong flooded quite regularly. Every 2, 3, 4, 5 years, you'd have a decent flood. Everything would be taken downstream. All the rubbish would go to Footscray. So if Essendon starts developing in the 1860s or 1850s and 1860s, by the time you get to the 1890s, there's still the population growth
increased.
Will do. And all of the land had been sort of subdivided. It had come down. The houses came marching down the hill. So all of the when it was a wetlands area, it was a tip, and the local area around it was very agricultural. It all got divided down into houses, so that there's a block next door. The house is only about 10 or 15 metres away from where we're actually standing now. And so people started complaining about this smelling tip. It had all of their rubbish in it. It actually also had dead animals in it and things like that at a time when horses were used for transport and everything like that. There were a lot more animals in people's lives, and they tended to throw the dead animals down here. What they did when they got too smelly in the height of summer, they would pour kero over everything and they would light it up. And it would burn for days. And the smoke would just pour on up the hill. And people would stop complaining about the smell and start complaining about the smoke. So the community said that they had to fix this problem of their sinking tip. And what the council had decided to do was to get some incinerators. That was going to be much cleaner. And what you do with an incinerator is that you burn everything. It has a big chimney. All the smoke comes out the top. You don't put the chimney down the bottom of the hill. It doesn't really make sense. So they were going to put incinerators up in Ascot Vale. And, of course, the people in Ascot Vale don't want all the rubbish coming to them. So the community fought over where they were going to put these incinerators.
for decade after decade. Ultimately, what happened is that it was almost an argument about aesthetics. I didn't want to smell in their neighbourhood and all of that sort of stuff. But after World War One, we have the Spanish flu going globally, and in Melbourne, it makes people very health conscious during the 1920s. And essentially, that was a motivator. This idea of disease and hygiene was a big motivator for council to actually invest really big money in finding their solution. It was okay, but for the community to spend £17,000, which I've seen quoted as something like the equivalent of $5 million in today's money, which was a big investment for them. But what they did is that they found a little company called Rico. Actually, it wasn't called Rico at the time, but the reverberatory incinerator company was being formed. They had some little working models of their incinerators in Box Hill, in Sandringham, and one in Geelong. And essentially what they are is that they are smelting furnaces. They burn at very, very high temperatures. And there's a system whereby the smoke and the ash, the particles that would normally come out of a chimney get passed over the flames time and time again, and before they get released through the chimney, and it means that very little visible smoke comes out of these incinerators. The other thing about these incinerators is that very little smell comes out of them. The process, if we quickly go through the process, the hall that we were in earlier up the top was where all the rubbish came in. These hoppers are underneath the wooden floorboards. The rubbish came directly dumped into these, into these concrete hoppers that are above us, and they fell down. And then where it was kept, there was a big electric motor, a big electric fan that actually sucked air down the hoppers so that no smell of the rubbish would come out and annoy our neighbours. And then it was burnt in these incinerators with no smoke really coming out the top. And then there was one more level just around the incinerators too, where people could empty the small amounts of ash, people could empty the ash without actually having to get inside them, just by lifting these black doors that you can see. The incinerators before these incinerators were essentially big metal boxes. People opened doors, they filled it up with rubbish, they burnt it, they closed the doors, they burnt it, then they opened them and they shoveled out all of the ash. This was a gravity-fed system where people didn't need to handle the rubbish. So it was seen as a very clean, very healthy way of getting rid of the waste. The community here said, that's wonderful, spend all of this money. And Rico came up with this drawing of a little industrial building and they went nuts again. Essentially, the people who were from Aberfeldy, the Aberfeldy Progress Association, had kind of lost the argument. The incinerators were coming down here, because it was going to be clean and no smoke. And they said that this wasn't an industrial neighbourhood. They didn't want an industrial building. So essentially they were back to square one with the community up in arms about the incinerators coming down here. So Rico, and you can see on the big brass plate, on the plate here, they have their address at 46 Elizabeth Street in Melbourne. And that was actually a Burley Griffin building. It's been pulled down in the late 60s, I think, early 70s. But Rico was owned by a guy called Leonard Kaninsky. He owned 46 Elizabeth Street. He had his office on the top floor, and Burley Griffin's office, Melbourne office, was down just a few flights of stairs. So I always say that actually it's very much a coincidence that they went to the Griffins to find a design for their incinerator. But the fact that they did is really kind of quite remarkable, in as much as the Griffins with their background in the Griffins with their that's a picture of 46 Elizabeth Street, and essentially that was one of the earliest iron framed sort of skyscraper design buildings, where it's where you have the frame structurally holding up the building, and so you've got windows all the way down the front. The Griffins came from that school of architecture that's called the Chicago School or Prairie School Architecture. What they were about was fitting their buildings into the environment. So Frank Lloyd Wright, who was also part of that movement, had that line that a house should be off the hill and not on the hill. And so the genius of this building is about making an industrial building that fitted into Melbourne suburbia of the late 1920s, early 1930s. So it's got a long tiled roof. It looks like all the other roofs around it. It's actually based on a house that he built in Chicago in 1906 called the Peters House. But it's also, it's built up on a scale, so it looks a little bit like a church hall or something like that. And I guess when people write about this building, they often talk about this idea of form following function. So Louis Sullivan was a mentor of Burleigh Griffin, Frank Lloyd Wright, the Chicago school. He came up with that phrase, form follows function. And you can see in this building, like, we have these irregular kind of looking shapes of windows and doors and lots of triangles and diagonals and everything like that. And everything just follows this gravitational fall of the rubbish from up the top to down the bottom here. So it's having the function of the building dictating all of the forms in here, but being able to work with that aesthetically to create a really sort of beautiful building. It worked really well, but because of all of these, and they were very proud of how well the incinerators worked, it actually did solve their environmental problem, I guess. But because of all these delays with the community getting involved, the city engineers had plenty of time to think about what they were going to do with all of their rubbish. So the reason why we have two buildings here on site is that the city engineers worked out that if they were going to be creating all this heat from burning all of their rubbish, they should put that to good use, and they don't need to be just radiating that out into the atmosphere. So we have two buildings here, because the building right next to it became the centre for road surfacing in what was then Essendon. Mm. They kept the heat, with the heat, they kept the big bitumen boiler going, and they had steamrollers in the front building, and that they went off and did road surfacing all over Essendon and Flemington. They also, the big white building you might have noticed as you came down the hill, which is an aged care facility now, it used to be the Essendon Base Hospital. They did all the sanitising of equipment with their big steam kettles. So it was a really lovely system. The ash, if we talked about this being a wetlands area originally, the ash was actually used to make all of the parks that are out the back here. So there's an athletics track, there's still a depot there, but there's an athletics track. And some ovals and things like that. So all of this side of the river has been raised up from about 12 years of collecting ash every day from these incinerators. So it did only operate for 12 years. It shut down in 1942. Essentially, in 1942, you had the council stopped collecting the rubbish because of the war effort, and they just said it was too much manpower. People had to bury it in their own backyard, or they had to burn it in their own backyard. And the other thing, the thing that happened after World War II is that trucks got much, much bigger. So it became, the rubbish problem was sort of summarised as being a transport problem. You could fill up the first trucks that came here in the 1930s with these little jalopy things, tiny little utes. After the war, they're big troop moving trucks, and they could move tons and tons of rubbish out at 60 miles an hour. And so ever since the early 1940s, Melbourne has all gone back to landfill, and we just drive it out of sight. I couldn't tell you where most of our landfill goes. It just leaves my house and goes somewhere else. Yeah, we tell that story as a part of what we do here at the Incinerator Gallery. We talk about the social activism that it took to actually get their elected officials to come up with a solution for their environmental problem. And we talk about agency in the community to actually make changes to their community, to the built environment, I guess, around them. And we talk about contemporary art in those terms. So we have an award that explicitly is called Art for Social Change, and we do that every year, the Incinerator Art Award. But we also look at how contemporary art and contemporary life work together, and how artists have agency. And all of our exhibitions are like the exhibition that's on now, the group show, is called Without Fail, and it's about that nervousness of failure in all sorts of different aspects of our lives, and it's something that artists have responded to in really interesting ways. This idea of just exhibiting is this idea of being judged somehow, measured, that's sort of typical of some of the program that we do, of the programming that we do here with our contemporary art. One, before we go upstairs, if people want to look at the architecture from the outside, there's we can come out here, we can stand on the little hill, and we can look back at the building and see some of the features.
Yeah, so while the tip did go, it actually just got converted into the depot that's still used next door, and it's a recycling spot now. The thing that I always talk about this, in the things that I often note from here, are things like the windows and the decoration on the chimney and the little colonnade that's along here. There were things that Burley Griffin wanted to make aesthetically pleasing, but at the same time it had to be a really utilitarian building. It had to be really cheap to make. Councils weren't going to spend a lot of money making the building too pretty. All of the windows are just made from precast concrete. The colonnade here is just sewage pipes filled with concrete. Yeah, everything is done in a really inexpensive way, just so he can put in just a few of these little markers to, I guess, distract to some extent from the fact that it's an industrial building. And I think from this angle, I think the high roof and so on sort of gives it that real sort of church look and feel to it. People talk about an ecclesiastic look to the building. Yeah. And the two buildings, the front building that we can see there isn't actually the Burley Griffin bit. That's not a Burley Griffin building. That was designed by the city engineers and someone from Burley Griffin's office. But there were quite a few people that were involved in making that building, bringing that building into existence, yeah. Well, I think we can probably wander back on up and continue on.
Can I ask, you were saying, was this lower out here? Was the ground at this level, or is it feels as though it probably went down a bit?
There were channels that were dug in, so that there were little carriages that you might see in a mine. A little track was laid, and it ran all the way out here. And the ash was, so that the channels were about a metre 20 deep. And so the ash was just raked out, fell into that, and then the little track would come out and dumped all of the ash out here. When you see the historical photos, it's much flatter. So all of this has been built up with the ash, and all the ovals that are back there are being made level with the ash.
And it does have a cloister feel along there, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
Thank you very much. Well, welcome everybody again to the Incinerator Gallery. My name's Christine Healy and I manage the schools and community learning programs here at the gallery. And I have previous experience in other institutions and worked in the sector for around almost 10 years.
I'm Nick McGrath. I'm on the New Cardigan, we call ourselves Cardicore Committee. I'm also on the Committee for Australian Society of Archivists Vic Branch, and I'm the archivist at the museum. So I guess today I'm talking about my experience, my observations at the museum, because often I'm in the archives or the dungeons, as some people think. They're like, oh, Nick's come out, the vampire's come out of the archive.
It's like in the IT crowd, isn't
that's
it?
That's right. So I do make lots of observations and work on some, I think my role has changed and probably the role of archivists and GLAM institutions changing. We're expected to be more outward facing, but I'll go into that. So hi, everybody.
Thank you.
My name's Sasha. I really enjoy my job title. I'm the Visitor Experience Coordinator at the National Sports Museum, which is a sort of half education, half front of house and half volunteer management. So it can be quite busy. Mm.
And I'm Andrew Hiskins, and until recently I was the Manager of Learning Services at State Library Victoria, and before that, Public Programs at State Library Victoria. So that was 22 years of my life. And I finished at State Library Victoria on the 1st of March, and it's incredibly liberating, actually, to leave a large organisation where, a lot of your effort goes to use your creativity to sort of solve the problems that the system creates. Mm. Yeah. And background also, prior to that, in terms of this sector, because I've worked in this sector for about 35 years, but who's counting, at one stage I was the manager of Como House, the National Trust, And in the 80s, I lived in London, and I managed to luck my way into a job at the Victoria and Albert Museum. So I worked on exhibitions at the V&A for about 6 years. So, and I'm now setting myself up as a consultant, which is incredibly exciting. So there you go. Talk to me about rates if you need.
Thank you. And also the credentials of three quarters of our panel is that we're also on the NV committee, which is Education Network Victoria. And we have a website, which is amaganv.com, that people can go and have a look at to see the sort of work that we do and what our committee is like.
And we've been on the committee of, or on the executive of those things too at different times, Christine.
Yeah, that's right, of the national committee as well. So, and Sasha's on that at the moment too. So, and that's in with the Australian Museums and Galleries Association. It's a special interest group as part of that. Part of my thinking for today was I was really excited to have a program that ran at my workplace at the Incinerator Gallery, which I'm really proud of, and to have Richard Chilk talk about the history. And in thinking about how we might link that in with a conversation with mostly educators, but people with an interest in public programs and community engagement in the GLAM sector, I was thinking about how the Incinerator only functioned for about 12 years, which made me think about some of the research that's coming out of my own PhD research into the practices and pedagogies of museum educators, and thinking about, and this is really kind of emerging thinking, which is another reason why I wanted to talk about it, is I think that we're starting to witness the demise of the gallery educator or the museum educator. And I've got a few reasons to kind of back my thinking up, because at first it was just a feeling that I had. And so now I'm starting to actually think that there's reasons for this. And part, I might just go through them and so for us to discuss. Mm-hmm. So when the profession started in Victoria, it was mainly teachers that were seconded into institutions to provide classes that or programs that reflected the thinking of the Department of Education, and it providing links to school curriculum and making it relevant for teachers within these institutions. And we don't no longer have seconded teachers in Australia. And so I think that we had a really strong base of educators working in these institutions that were collegiate and had strong connections with one another, that as this profession gets, I'm thinking watered down in my words, but I don't know that they're the right words that I want to use, but with people that don't have education backgrounds that are coming into the profession that are kind of broadening it up. And at the same time as this happening, so it's also increasingly difficult for schools to visit. The professional organisations are difficult to sustain, so getting memberships and getting people along to things like this as a profession is becoming increasingly difficult. There's no real clear career path into the role. Mm. Are you happy if I just keep going?
Yeah, or out.
Or out. Mm. So there's no university courses, there's no formal training or study that prepares people for this type of role and the type of thinking that we're doing, or for where that might lead to is a career future, which also kind of ties into a little bit of this curators versus educators and the education term and the way that information's understood and interpreted within a museum or a gallery. Also, the broadening of the role as our roles are not only about schools now and relating to the curriculum and children's learning, it's also broadened out to include lifelong learning. And that's at both ends, from babies all the way through to senior people. So our whole community. And education is actually really well positioned to be able to find out what those communities need and want to be able to do that. But at the same time, our institutions are also being, the mission, education is becoming one of the core missions of our institutions, which becomes broadened out across so that everyone's role within the organisation is to do education. So then what is education? What is it left? What does it become? And I'm just finding these sorts of things, I think, are kind of making it more difficult for the profession to kind of exist in its own right. External organisations like Museum Hack and the School of Life are also coming in and offering alternate programming. And I'm just really interested to know what other people think about this, because it could just be something I've made up in my head. Well, there could be some truth.
I think there's definitely truth in what you're saying. I can only sort of talk from my own experiences since I started the Melbourne Museum. So 3.5 years ago, and I've noticed areas that are growing and areas that are not growing. So the number of jobs growing in marketing and philanthropy is huge. And we have a new department called Digital Life. So there's a new area within Digital Life. It's called MB Stories, where there's a lot of people that have media backgrounds that are coming in, so ex-journalists and things like that, coming in to tell stories of the museum that probably were being told by educators in the past. So that's my own observation. The education department's still a very strong department within the museum, but I've noticed that other areas are growing faster and bigger. So just the, you know, I've seen less jobs coming up in the collections areas and curators and collection managers sort of roles, and some areas are under-resourced and some areas just seem to be getting all of the funding and resourcing. So, you know, within the library, for example, in the archives, which where I work, we're a very small team, but, you know, we're servicing a staff of 600 and volunteers 600 again. And then there's the community that are coming in with inquiries. So more and more people are understanding that there is an archive in the museum because these stories are coming out digitally, but we're not getting increased resourcing to support that.
So in addition to doing all your own work that you're doing around collections and archives and material, there's also this interaction with the general public that is also kind of being swept in or brought into the role as well.
Exactly.
And that's where the funding seems to be directed to, with this engagement and how to bring people in through the doors.
That's right. And I think the other thing I've noticed is, you know, often in the past, I think, you know, people that were attracted to working in collections were often liked, you know, kind of introverts and weren't really outward facing. And now we're kind of being forced into that realm, not necessarily getting any within our degrees. So there's no kind of, I don't think that kind of field or part of our expertise isn't being cared for in the master's degrees that we're studying. So it's like they're like 10 years behind where we're going. So I think that needs to change as well. If we're expected to do this work, we need to get some support. Like I, which you wouldn't probably believe because I'm sitting here talking to you, I hate doing public speaking. Yeah. It kills me. I actually started volunteering at the State Library and did story time in front of 200 kids to help me get over that fear. Yeah. But it's actually helped me a lot because I have to do a lot of public speaking now. And one of the other things is being part of New Cardigan. We do a lot of speaking. We interview people, which is terrifying as well, in a studio setting. And I'm just like, blah, blah, blah. I don't know how I sound on recordings. I don't want to listen to myself. It's like, oh, my God. But, yeah, a lot of those thoughts that were kind of... It's a large part of my job now, basically.
Yeah.
So...
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Sasha.
Oh, so there was a couple of things you mentioned that really resonated with me. I'm conscious that I'm the newest to the glam sector on the panel. I've been, let's say, explicitly working in museums for 3 years. I had a couple of things that touched on the sector earlier on when I was a performer. There is no direct pathway. So when I was studying a graduate diploma of education, I heard that it was possible to do a placement in some other kind of thing other than a school, and I thought, I'm not sure about classroom teaching. That sounds like a great idea. That was my in. I managed to... It's funny, people talk about luck a lot in the sector. I was lucky and this and that, and I said to my museum manager, I was very lucky. I got an internship at the National Museum of Australia. He said, how did you get there? And I said, well, I cycled around the lake in Canberra to every single national institution asking until someone said yes. He said, that didn't sound like luck at all. But there's two points I want to respond to. One is the pathway. I've landed now in a position at the National Sports Museum, which is a permanent position, after 6 concurrent temporary contracts of 3, 3, 6, 9, 2, and 14 months.
All at the Sports Museum?
No, the first 3 were at the National Museum, and then without a gap, just smoothly segued down. That's really challenging in lots of ways. Mm. And now I'm not sure what progression happens next. I think I stay where I am for a while. And the second thing I wanted to respond to was about the pressure on the roles. So my experiences were in the ACT, at that whole national conglomerate amalgamation nexus thing on the lake, and a little bit in Western Australia and a little bit in Victoria. In Canberra, The environment there has a couple of strong structural issues which is affecting the sector. One is the efficiency dividend, which has been going for about 25 years, and that is that it's a certain number of percentage per year that all federal institutions lose from their budget. The theory behind...
Well, it's applied to departments, but it trickles down.
Yeah.
It means, and in a department which is much, much bigger, there's more capacity to absorb. Mm. The real issue for institutions is that there's no capacity.
It affects all of those national cultural institutions, with the exception of the Australian War Memorial. But I won't go into that. The theory behind it is that productivity gains can be taken into account and you can restructure things to do the same or more with less. It doesn't work quite so well in museum education.
Why do you say that?
Because in my direct team there, we had four members delivering education to students. There's about 90,000 students visit a year. About 30,000 students have a directed program. If you were to continue to increase the number of programs that the same number of staff were delivering, they would go mad. So there's a challenge there. And the other challenge in the ACT is the, I forget the acronym, there's an acronym for it, but they're trying to reduce the staffing levels back to the level they had in 2007, which is going to put that pressure down again. So those are the two points that really resonated with me, the pathways and the structural issues.
Okay, thank you. Andrew.
Okay, and actually I should add, because you didn't say about your own pathway, that another interesting part about Sasha's pathway was that circus arts is a great way, is a great thing to study to end up working in this kind of role, because we end up doing a heap of juggling, don't we? So, look, there are a couple of things that, and I mean, obviously we're all going to say, and that resonated for me, and that resonated, and we're in a room that resonates. Engagement, I think, is one of the interesting things, because I think one of the, I think a trend that I'm seeing is this move to actually naming engagement. I mean, you know, State Library of Victoria has had a director of engagement, right? And there are other people who have engagement in their titles. And I think engagement is a good thing, and it's an important thing, but it's a how, not a what. And I think that's really interesting, because it's a how in the sense that engagement is one of the things that underpins people's ability to learn in cultural institutions, to find out stuff and so on. Without engagement, they're not interested. So it's actually a motivator. And I think putting it front and foremost, I think, you know, it's one of those things. It's a bit of a pendulum shift. It will probably go back the other way at some time in the future. But I think it's a kind of focus on something that denies the other purposes. And I think it's interesting talking about doing story time at the State Library, because that was an area that I was responsible for. And one of the things about doing something like a story time is that it feels like it's a nice, lovely, sort of joyous little social occasion. But there was something that I read from OECD, just looking at, they did a kind of survey of the different language around formal education, informal education. And they also talked about non-formal education. It's not something that we particularly think about, but informal, obviously, you would understand that. Formal clearly is about where you're doing a course, or you've signed up for something. Non-formal sits in between, and the purpose of that program is understood by the people providing it. But the people who sign up for it aren't overtly thinking, I'm going to learn something. And that's what happens, for example, in a story time. You get multiple aspects of learning. Mm. And the people running the story time totally understand that they're doing a learning program. But the participants, mm-hmm. whether they're the kids or whether it's the parents for whom how to do this reading to children thing is being modelled, don't necessarily think of that. So it's kind of learning by stealth. And what I think one of the issues that we might potentially lose in the way in which things are shaping is just that one, that engagement trumps everything else, and that becomes a much more surface thing, because engagement, like, what are your metrics for engagement? How many people? And it's always and it's not about it's breadth but not depth.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the issues. A couple of other things, if I may. One is just that notion of what's a deeper purpose. And so the kind of macro view of stuff that's happening in education at the moment, in the national curriculum there's a thing called the general capabilities. Victorian curriculum has a slightly cut down version called the capabilities, but the key ones, well, because the national one includes literacy and numeracy, which Victoria kind of thinks we've covered that in other aspects. It's embedded, we don't have to, it would be counting it twice, was the logic, I believe. So it includes critical and creative thinking, intercultural understanding, ethical understanding, personal and social, so like resilience and all of those kinds of things. Now these are the things that are often thought of as the soft skills. But if you're thinking about that whole issue of jobs and AI and all of that kind of stuff, these are the things, these are future work skills, these are future how do you thrive at life skills.
Mm. Genevieve Bell calls them core skills.
Core skills.
It's a much better name.
And so and also they're the things that aren't easily replicated by machine intelligence. So there's something in that, and like they're in the curriculum, as I said, part of the purpose. There's a wonderful phrase which I might have to look up from the Melbourne Declaration, which was the Joint Ministers of Education back in 2007 or 8 or 9, it's some time ago now, and it's going to be reviewed, talking about creating sort of active and informed citizens and, you know, competent young people. It's words to that effect. And these are the things that help to do that. The problem is that they're not very easily measured. And that's why they don't get counted. But you're seeing a bit of a shift at the moment. Mark Scott was in the Sydney Morning Herald just last week questioning the value of an ATAR score. And that's a pretty valuable thing because, you know, so there's this kind of shift that says, what can we measure more broadly? Mm. Now, if you think about how people might learn capabilities, then I think cultural organisations are incredibly well placed to do that. And I think that's a really strong argument that can be made. And I think that, you know, what I would dearly love is to work out a way in which we could get someone to help us fund a piece of work or research or something like that that might go towards proving that. And the other thing that I just want to touch on briefly is just that notion of trust. And I think that cultural organisations are often a bit too self-satisfied about the notion of trust. It's kind of like, yeah, of course, we're trusted institutions. Everyone trusts us. But to some extent, that's true. And I think if you look at stuff like the Edelman Trust Barometer or whatever it's called, and looks at trust across government, media, business, and so on, I think that that's an incredibly important thing, and particularly at a time where you've got that sort of lack of trust in government or lack of trust in the media, where else do people go to for their trust?
Yeah.
And so I think that there are a number of macro things that come into play in thinking about that. Mm. And I think all of those things, like trust, is do you trust, like, do people put trust in AI or other things, or do they trust people? And I think generally speaking, trust is something of people, not of systems.
Yeah. And that goes hand in hand with the authority of the institutions as places that are creating and constructing knowledge. And it's kind of interesting, you know, thinking about postmodernism and how that questions all of that authority as well. But I think you're quite right in saying that museums and galleries and these spaces have all kind of remained above that and kept that authority, I think, in people's perceptions. What you were talking about before with the curriculum, do people's minds just go to mush when someone says curriculum something, something, something? And that's kind of one of the magic powers, I think, that gallery educators have, because we have, some of us...
Just don't mention the C word.
Well, if you want to assert yourself as a gallery educator and to talk about the value of your programs, to start talking, to referencing what it is that you do back to the curriculum, people are kind of left for dead. And sometimes you don't even have to understand what you're saying, but, I mean, it's good if you do. But it's kind of a magic language. And in your talking before, Andrew, I was thinking, wouldn't it be great if we had a curriculum and, you know, there have been curriculums kind of devised for early years learning, but what about for adult learning? I know the Public Pedagogies Institute based at Vic Uni is doing really good work around this and creating pedagogies for people. Wouldn't it be great if we had some sort of learning frame for adult learning? I don't know, what do you think?
Well, to add to what you say, the first museum education job I ever applied for at the Powerhouse Museum, the feedback of my unsuccessful interview was that I was not assured enough in my discussion of the curriculum. And that's the one reason they gave me. There was probably other reasons that I didn't get the job.
Yeah.
So that resonates really strongly.
Yeah, well, the curriculum, you know, when you're not working with it in a school network, is this kind of anamorphous thing that's really difficult to kind of pin down and tap into and to understand how do I access this as a gallery educator for teachers, for it to have relevance to them. And I think maybe some of the strength in the role of museum educators tied up in that. But what if we were to broad, what if governments, or what if there was a broadening of how adults learn and how other people learn that was able to be measured against, rather than it just being, as you say, engagement and very surface level activity and interaction.
I think the museum is sort of focusing more programs around adult, you know, 18 plus and then up, older. So I've noticed in the last 3 years, things, programs at the planetarium, so nocturnal, so kind of these events that are meant for 18 plus.
At Mad Max the other day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was fantastic. I wasn't there, but yeah, that looked amazing. I would have loved to be there. But yeah, so I think so. Science Works has a long history of bringing, you know, since the early 90s, of bringing large groups of students through. So, big groups of school groups coming through.
Yeah, well, there was funding for it.
Exactly. Mm. And I think now there's a focus that, you know, exhibitions can be also targeted towards adults, and programs around exhibitions can, you know, bring in the younger audiences as well. For example, Nocturnal is really bringing in that 18 plus, that early 20s. And I've often bring out some archive art items, and I always laugh when I see people, you know, adults running towards Farlap, and I'm like, I'm over here with the archive material, and then, you know, they've been drinking quite a lot of wine, and they've got lots of wine breath, and they're like, oh, what's over here? And I'm like, wow. And they're like, often the discussion is, I haven't been to the museum since I was a kid. So I think that's exciting that the museum is trying to, the strategic plan is sort of getting younger audiences, but also adults as well. I mean, we always have the older audiences, like the grandparents that bring their kids to the museum. So,
but what do you think museums could do that would increase the level of engagement that people have, rather than just all these extra numbers coming, which is easy to measure?
Yeah.
How do we know that something authentic is happening, that they're actually having an experience where they are learning and discovering new things and ways of thinking and having those experiences?
Well, there's the whole audience insights department, which is a part of the museum that works around those numbers and stats. So they do a lot of focus group work. They even did focus group work around the children's gallery redevelopment a few years ago, and they had little babies up to 5-year-olds in a room interacting with bits of material and texture. And so that was a lot of work that they were doing with the community that would be using that space. And the same thing they could do for adults. I don't know if there's any work going on around that at the moment, but I'm sure it will be. So they're constantly, we get reports from the audience insights about, so they stand near the door and then they just try and grab people and get some information. And that information's really analysed and, you know, in a way, how can we change our programs and exhibitions for these audiences?
So is that external or internal?
That's internal staff. Yeah. So there's a department, there's a unit that looks after that. And it's a really important part of what we do, because it's all about visitation for museums and what are the numbers of people coming through the doors. And with digital life, how many people are hitting on the museum sites and all of the platforms now. So and we need to do that because, you know, government funding really... It's starting to increase, but for a long time, for about 10 years, it hadn't increased. But in the last, since our new CEO, Lindley Croswell, has started with the museum, hopefully I got her surname correct, because it was Marshall, and she's recently changed it. I think it's Croswell. Just putting it out there. But yeah, I think things have changed with she's going to the minister, and actually the funding has kind of increased in recent times, which is exciting, because hopefully more programs can come out of it.
So what I'm hearing in that is that there's more jobs in evaluation?
I think there's a lot of jobs in marketing and media and branding, philanthropy, because, you know, even though the money has slightly increased from government, we still need the support of other funding sources because, yeah, you know, it costs a lot of money to run the museum. If you look around the museum, look up, it's scary how many kind of holes and imperfections are around the building. So just things like the building, which terrifies me, you know, flooding, and there's a hole above, right near the archives, which is just terrifies me every time there's a downpour. So there's like the basic things that need to happen. So the foundations of the building itself needs support. So we need more money coming into museums.
For those invisible things.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
At the National Sports Museum, we're just about to do a refresh. We're going to close for 6 months, do a whole bunch of stuff, reopen again. As part of that, we had an external audience insights process happen, which then informs the design. I think evaluation is actually one of the harder parts of cultural institutions because of the amorphous alchemy of learning, Andrew often mentions. We don't quite know how it might happen. What we found out is that 50% of our visitors are under 16, which changes not only how you present things, but what you present. I recently retired Ian Thorpe's shoe from the touch trunk, because if everyone's under 16, then Ian Thorpe isn't relevant to that. The kids coming in can't even remember the last Australian Olympics that happened, and my volunteers are from the previous Australian Olympics that happened. So that's confusing. In terms of the money flowing around, I've got a few numbers I want to throw out there, because there is a lot of money flowing into some buildings, not necessarily upkeep of buildings, but where are my numbers? ACME got $40 million for their visionary transformation. Vic Library, $88 million.
Ish. Well, that was the total cost.
The total
but
cost.
We had to raise about $29 million.
Sure, I'm just going totals here.
Yeah.
NSM $17 million, $5 million from the state government, and a new museum, Vietnamese museum, got $2.55 million. It's going to be built soon as well. That's just here in Victoria, but they're not saying let's fund more educators. So. I think you said it would be great to have more programs. Mm. Maybe it's more programs, but it's not. It's capital works. And I wonder if anyone else on the panel can explain with some context why is it there's these tens of millions of dollars going to buildings and not to the people that work in them? Is it a better sell or...?
Well, in part, there's an economic benefit from building things because you actually employ
a
whole lot of architects and builders and electricians and tradies and
sure,
all those kinds of things.
Not educators.
Well, no, not educators. But I think there's a danger in thinking that if we're growing, say, the marketing team and the philanthropy team and so on, that's just kind of, you know, I don't know, a bit of a wank, really. But it's interesting. If you think about some of the cultural institutions that have had amazing growth, if you look around the world and look at somewhere like Tate under Nick Sirota, I was fortunate because years ago I did the Museum Leadership Program. It's run through what was MA, now AMAGA, with Gordon Darling Foundation. And they do masterclasses each time they do a refresher. And the last masterclass I went to was only last year. And Nick was actually our masterclass teacher, which was fantastic because there are a whole lot of insights that we got that we... because it was Chatham House rules, we can't repeat certain things. But one of the clear insights was just the level of resourcing that went into those areas and how that worked, because they had these aspirations to, you know, because like when I lived in London in the 80s, Tate was a building on Millbank, one building, and then, and it's now, there's Tate Modern, there's Tate St Ives, there's Tate Liverpool, it's kind of, and you see that with other institutions as well, and also expanding internationally. So I think there's an underlying thing where if you invest in some of that stuff, I mean, you need to be careful, but actually it's about the idea of growing the pie. So it's not about how you slice the pie up smaller, and we all of us tend to, I mean, our default position is to think, oh, I want more of that pie, without thinking that you can somehow magically make it different, and it's not magic. There are certain ways in which you can do that, and I think that's one of the ways. So that's just... just an observation about that.
How do we as educators grow the pie, Andrew?
Well, I think that... So if you think about... All right. There's a really great book by a guy called Adam Grant called Give and Take. Adam Grant is he's a professor at Wharton in the US. He's the youngest professor at Wharton, the youngest ever professor at Wharton. And his specialisation is sort of, you know, psychology in business, that kind of, you know, organisational psychology. And the premise of this book, which is well-researched and well-evidenced, so it's, you know, it's nicely footnoted, and here's the study that did this, and here's the study that did that, is that there are three types of people, essentially, looking at that idea of giving and taking. There are givers, takers, and matchers. So matchers, obviously, are people who kind of naturally think in a quid pro quo way. Takers are obviously the people who sort of inflate their own egos and are the smartest guys in the room. And givers are people who give of themselves. Who's the most successful? Any ideas?
Matches.
Actually, the evidence suggests that the givers are the most successful, but only if you consider one other dimension, and that dimension is enlightened self-interest. So, because the danger of giving is that you can overgive and therefore you deplete your resources. So you shrink the pie, or at least you give even your little bit of the pie to others. So in answer to your question, and I mean this is a kind of philosophical answer
Please.
To the question, but is I think that we need to be, I think that we need to embrace that notion of giving with enlightened self-interest. And I think we need to think about our self-interest, but not in a way that excludes others. So that self-interest has to be our self-interest within the ecosystem of our organisation's self-interest, etc., and expand it out. And I think if we can do that, but equally if we can convey more the value of the education thing, and that goes to that issue of what's the highest calling, and if we can help equip young people to be capable and confident citizens and all of those kinds of things, if that's the work that we can do, and if we can have people believe that that's the work that we're doing within our institutions, then that higher calling starts to be really significant.
So then what we need to do as a profession is to better articulate what it is that we do.
Yeah. Well, yes, but also don't just go... So there's also a danger... is if you can think something through rationally, here's the rational response to this, here's the reason, we fail to realise that most people actually make decisions because of emotions. So it's actually because that's how the heuristics work. So I think we actually need to not only know the rational argument, but we also need to be able to work out how do we translate that into terms where people will respond emotionally in the ways that we would like them to respond.
And at scale for increased visitation.
Or a deeper experience. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be... But if we're going to have a deeper experience, we need to be able to work out a way in which the deeper experience gets valued as highly. Because there are things that can be transformative, you know. I was at Remix in Sydney the last couple of days, and I was talking to someone who'd said it was called Rare. She'd come out of the advertising industry... And it's about having diverse people involved in diversity in the kind of the creative teams. And they just don't, you know, on the whole. One of the things she told about was someone who'd got an internship that they had organised and then had got a job. And, like, the person who was at the conference told her that through the internship that this person did, they'd just been given the job. And so that's a transformative thing for an individual. That's changed someone's life. So I think we can't forget that we actually have the capacity to change people's lives. Again, our problem is it's very hard to measure.
Yeah, and I think that we all come to these positions after having had those experiences ourselves, and that's what makes these spaces so exciting and interesting to work in, because we've all had the Kool-Aid.
Well, and that's the other risk too, because... I think that there is a problem. We were just talking before about, you know, a strategic planning and the danger sometimes where you've got subject matter experts who run organisations and strategic planning simply reflects a belief system.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't actually make a case.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we have to be careful about that as well, because we probably are all true believers, but we also have to, if we are true believers, then we also have to be atheists at the same time and actually critique our own beliefs.
Yep. Yeah.
And understand why we need to make the argument still.
So in the 80s, Stephen Dobbs and Elliot Eisner did a research study interviewing art museum directors about educators in museums and the value of their roles. And many of the directors at the time in the 80s didn't even know what their education team did, let alone how to talk about the benefits of what it was that they were doing. And one director went so far as to say that the collection was known in history, not the programs that they run at the museum, known by the public, not by the programs that they run within the institutions, and that the collection is what's important and should be valued in museums. And I think that we've certainly seen that change. So Dobbs and Eisner made a number of recommendations for the provision that have occurred in the States, but I think that they also speak to us in Australia and what we can do to improve the profession. And so some of these recommendations were to have a summer institute where people could get together and have these conversations and learn from one another, a handbook, more research, which we've talked about, a journal, and video of how to enact this role. I know when I came to the role and, I was told this is my job, and you go in and then you think, well, how am I going to do this? And what's best practice? And how do I know what I'm doing is working? And, how do I figure these things out? And it's difficult. And that's what led me to Envy, to try and answer some of those questions and reach out to other people, because they might be doing something better than what I'm doing and I can learn from that. So an annual conference also was recommended. Fellowships. Which was what I based my PhD research in going out to the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, the National Gallery of Australia and the Art Gallery of South Australia while they still had seconded teachers, and collaborative program development, which I think is really interesting for organisations to come together to collaborate on programs that they might run back in their own institution. So what other sort of positive things do you think that we could do to improve our lot within these institutions?
Something that comes up a bit at the museum is that there's this huge pool of retired staff that we kind of... Mm. And there's no kind of club for them. Like, they have their own... They have an official club where they meet up, but it'd be great... And this is something I've spoken to people that I've worked in the museum that were close to retirement, and they sort of talk to me about it. I'm like, it would be fantastic if there was an official club where they could come back and mentor staff. And I think this is something we haven't talked about really, is mentorship. Mm. And I'm constantly asking for it at the museum.
Yeah.
And I was lucky that a professor at Melbourne Uni just said to me, I want to mentor you. And I was like, oh, yes, I'm a really mentor. I was like, yes, yeah. Please. Because I know people are very busy. So sometimes when you feel like you go to someone that's busy that you respect and you look up to, and getting a bit of their time is difficult, but I think there should be an official mentor program at the museum and different cultural institutions so we can pull this knowledge and experience, because basically a lot of what we do is based on experience. You can't be taught. Your collection, your institution is very unique, and your job within it is unique.
Even your architecture that you're working within.
Yeah, exactly. So there's so many things that you can learn. So, and fortunately for me, being an archivist, I get to meet lots of past staff members that come and do research in the archives. Judy McKinty, I mentioned to you briefly before, she worked in the Children's Museum in the 80s and 90s, and she's doing a lot of research with Mary Featherston. Basically, they're doing a lot of work around the Children's Museum from the 80s and 90s, and some of those programs were quite revolutionary. I don't know if everybody knows about the Children's Museum from that time, but there was an Everybody exhibition and You're It, and there was a couple of really huge key exhibitions where it was a new way of learning for students. So they come in and you could actually touch things. So they talk about, the display case in the old museum in Russell Street was lots of display cases, and it was really set up for lots of objects on display. You walk up and you kind of have spent hours just looking at it. Not really set up for children. The labels weren't set up for children to learn. So the Children's Museum was developed, and a lot of the exhibitions were kind of interactive, and you could press buttons and work, you know, you could learn from engaging with the objects. And we still have a kind of interpretive collection from that, which isn't part of the state collection. It's sort of in no man's land. It's sort of, it's not state collection, but they're objects that you can handle. But okay. now they're becoming significant because we have things like Mary Featherstone designed objects in that collection. Mm. So I think, yeah, it's interesting. Talking to Judy, she said it used to be, they were called explainers in the late 80s and 90s, and they basically were staff that were experts in the exhibition and sat in the gallery and engaged with the public that came into the space. So I don't know if everyone, you might not know about this, but there was these beautiful sculptures in the Everybody exhibition that were life-size, and one of them was a pregnant lady, and a child ran up to it and put his ear against the belly and thought he heard a heartbeat. Of course, there wasn't. It was just in his mind. But Judy actually observed him coming back to the museum. He ran up and he said, "I can't hear the heartbeat." And she had to explain to him, maybe it was in his mind after being discussed with him. You know, this is a baby.
It was his heartbeat.
That's right. He's hearing it through, and it was quite lovely. But because she was there observing these sorts of interactions, she could engage with the students and make a far more enriched experience. I think now in the Children's Gallery it's a bit of a different model. There's still educational aspects, but it's about play, and there's customer service officers that work in that space, but they're not assigned to that space all the time, so they're not educators in that way. I would say they are educators, but I think that it's kind of in a way I think that's sad that we don't have that deep dive learning that happens. We have a lot of volunteers that work in the museum and take people on tours, and they have this extremely beautiful experience, and every individual brings their own experience to it. Yeah. So I think the other thing about working in the museum or glam sector is that you're kind of a jack of all trades. I think everyone that I speak to that ends up working in a museum or gallery or archive or library has a really interesting background, and I think that informs, you need to have a really broad understanding and kind of life experiences. I don't think you can just learn that from a university degree. And I think it's really about talking to people and coming to cutty parties and listening to podcasts and being active on Twitter and learning what's going on as well. So yeah, that's the only way you're going to really understand what's happening in the sector and what the trends are. And sometimes I find out things about my own organisation through Twitter rather than at work, because and if you're not on there, I think you need to get on there, basically.
Absolutely. So my museum used to have an education department, which is a kind of, it feels like a strange thing to say, and now it's gone from the education department running their own programs to trusting in the museum's implicit learning alchemy. So I run programs now, but some of them are holiday programs. I would do some stuff during closure for schools, but it's very different to having an education department that has the reins. Talking about mentorship made me think about the stability of the profession and what we talked about, the increased casualization of the profession as well. It's one thing to have a job and get mentoring, but it's another thing to have a job that allows you to afford to eat. I did a quick bit of research last night on the first 5 jobs of museum educators to pop up on the internet. And down the bottom here, Shrine of Remembrance has a casual education officer. The Tarawarra Museum of Art has a 2-year contract for 22.8 hours a week. Science Works, regular, part-time, fixed term, 2 positions. It's the irregular that really kills. Chinese Museum, sessional instructor according to availability. And the most stable job is actually from the TAC, the Transport Accident Commission, because they have a, I don't know what you call it, a little program happening down under Melbourne Museum, and that's for 2 years and 8 months. They were the first 5, and none of them were full-time, and none of them were permanent.
Yeah.
And this is an issue. The National Museum, in addition to keeping those 4 positions of the department I was in, they now have a casual pool to do the overflow, I guess we'll call it. But their corporate plan doesn't stipulate any additional number of students, so I don't quite know how to reconcile that capacity. And I was reading through the report from the Cultural Institutions in Canberra, and one of the submissions suggested there was 40,000 students missing out on cultural institution education programs through the lack of capacity of the educators in the network. Mm. Some places are booked out 2 years in advance.
Mm. Well, it certainly speaks to the changing nature of the workforce, and that people will be coming and going from the workforce, which makes it more difficult for professional organisations.
Mm. I think we could have a whole other discussion. I think we're trying to wrap
to
up.
But
I think, but I think there is a whole other discussion about scalability, and I actually think technology can help with scalability.
Yeah.
So let's have another discussion sometime on that.
We'll
at
do.
Lunch?
Really yeah. rich.
Well, at lunch, but I think we could actually do another one of these.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much to our panel for coming along today, and thank you for our audience and visitors for coming along. We didn't get a chance to invite you into the conversation as well, but hopefully it will carry on over lunch. So thank you, Justine.
No, thank you. Thank you all.
That was Christine Healy, Nick McGrath, Sasha Fawkes, Andrew Hiskins and Richard Ennis discussing all things Incinerator and learning in GLAM. Thanks for listening, folks. If you'd like to get in touch with New Cardigan, you can find us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. Remember, keep an ear out for more Cardicasts. Check out our website at newcardigan.org for events, merchandise, news and more. And always remember, folks, JFDI.